vocabulary. And the more he knows of the historical development of these languages, the better, more accurate job he's going to do in establishing the cognates. Some might even be willing to admit that the more a person is versed in linguistics, the better overall job you'll do. However, what is not generally known, as is evidenced by published chronological analyses, is just how poor a job will be done if one does not know the languages and or their historical development. And what is not generally known is that the more a person has studied in the field of linguistics, the more he will avoid doing a glottal chronology on languages he's not very familiar with, both synchronically and diachronically. When one is using old word lists collected by tourists and other travelers, one must be aware of the rather great difficulties that the traveler faces when he attempts to elicit words. Difficulties which the traveler himself might not be fully aware of. For example, not only does he not know the language in question, but often his consultant is weak in English. Another common problem is that even though the consultant does use English quite well, still some English terms are difficult to render in the native language, especially when they are given out of context, out of sentence context. For example, I have myself several times asked my Crow acquaintances what the Crow word for assertive is. I have often gotten no answer, but when I have gotten answers to this question, I get a word which it turns out means more like the English word pushy. Now, this does not necessarily mean that there is no word for assertive. It could very well mean that I haven't yet been able to contrast the meanings of assertive and pushy sufficiently enough for my consultants to understand what it is I'm after. Both Crow and Haidatsa are spoken today, and one can only wonder why Wood and Downer did not elicit the standard word list afresh. Whatever the reason, they chose to rely on published lexicons. For Crow, it is possible to follow Lowy's collection fairly well. But published Haidatsa materials are less than extensive and often unreliable. To assess their usefulness, one must virtually re-elicit them from present-day speakers. Such checking would have revealed to Wood and Downer that of their three Haidatsa sources, Washington Matthews's work is the most reliable, while Hayden's list is all but worthless. Unfortunately, Wood and Downer preferred Hayden to Matthews wherever possible. Their list cites 66 entries as coming from Hayden, but only 8 from Matthews. Another 25 from Maximilian, and the remaining one is, now I haven't been able to find it in any of the lists. The results of this source waiting are often disconcerting. Thus, I'll have to break off every once in a while for the Easter backboard. That's a word is given as the top one there, bideda, and this is from Hayden. The Haidatsa form seems to be Hayden's way of writing mideri, which is the second one on the board, which means he came in. The Haidatsa word for dog is mashuka. Like other forms of Hayden's list, bideda, being glossed as dog, is stunningly wide of the mark. At the gloss for lie, L-I-E, the crow form, excuse me, I didn't want to read on there, I'll come back to that. Another type of problem arises because of certain cultural habits. When I was a student in Philadelphia, in a field methods course, we had an informant, as they were called in those days, from Africa. Whenever we attempted to obtain the word for some object out of context, we were told instead what it was used for. If we pointed to a stick, we would get the equivalent of, that's what we drive the goats with. Or we found out that a chair is, quote, where the chief sits, unquote, and so on. So again, my first experience with Lakota resulted in obtaining many words for colors and for noises. But I was unaware of this for some time. For when I asked my consultant for the name of something by pointing to it, I would get something like, it is green, or it makes a crackling noise. And related to this, back to Wood and Donner again, at the gloss for lie, the crow form means to rest. The Haidatsa word means to tell a lie. Actually, the words for lie down are cognate in the two languages. At the gloss for breasts, the crow form is correct, but the Haidatsa word really means chest or thorax. The Haidatsa word for breasts is cognate with the crow. At the gloss for fly, the crow word means house fly, and the Haidatsa word means to fly. The words for house fly in these two languages are cognate. At the gloss for tail, the crow word means an animal's tail. The Haidatsa form means bird's tail, and the and both languages have words for both of these, and they are cognate. at the gloss for who, the crow form is a relative pronoun, the one who, etc. The haidatsa form is an interrogative. Again, both forms appear in both languages and are cognate. And this could go on and on for some time. A not completely different kind of problem arises from the fact that distinctions are made in one language that are not made in the other. For example, in the Athabaskan languages, there are several words for eat, and the one that is used depends on what type of food it is that's being eaten. The word for eat is different when you eat peas than when you eat lettuce, than when you eat meat or potatoes. Similar to this is the plain old ambiguity one finds in the meanings of words. When you use the word bank in English out of context, one doesn't know whether you're referring to the bank of a river or a financial institution. In the Wood and Donner article, there are numerous entries that reflect the pitfalls of this plain old-fashioned type of multiple meaning in English and in Crow and in Haidatsa. Another type of source problem appears at the entries for man and for person. For man, the Wood and Donner list give the Crow word bacha, which is right. The Haidatsa form from Hayden, bacha, which is close enough to be right. For person, they give the Crow word, well, it should be bilhbaga. Close enough to be right, but the Haidatsa word, and this time now the Haidatsa word is taken from Maximilian, whereas after man it was taken from Hayden, is Maximilian's rendering of Baotse. That is, it's the same word as man. The two Haidatsa entries, one from Hayden and one from Maximilian, are actually the same word. The Haidatsa word for person or people is cognate with the Crow word for person. Wood and Donner are aware of their Haidatsa sources, that these sources pose serious orthographic problems of the sort just pointed out. I think I'll leave this paragraph out. It gets a little mean. Now, many of the problems discussed above could have been avoided had Wood and Donner elicited a standard word list from present-day speakers of Crow and Haidatsa. Others, perhaps, could only have been caught by linguists who were experienced with these languages. And it so happens that there are linguists today working actively with both of these languages and with a comparative study of them. Wood and Donner should be praised, of course, for their determination to use all sources that they could find. But their linguistic innocence is to be regretted. The data, as you see, is so badly deformed that it is somewhat surprising that Wood and Donner were able to find as many as 79% of cognates in the word list. But they don't tell us which pairs of pro and hydaxa forms they considered cognate. I will not use the board to write down a number of pairs which look quite different from one another in the two languages, but which are cognate, and I would suspect that they did not find them cognate, although I don't know this for sure. And there are a couple of pairs in which the forms look very much alike indeed. Anyone who didn't know the languages would insist that they were cognate, but it turns out they're not. Now, maybe some of you are wondering whether I'm going to say anything substantive today, or I am. With the help of Wes Jones over at Mary College, I did work out the grado chronology of these two languages. There are 86% of forms cognate, and this places the separation of the two languages now, not the time when the languages themselves began to diverge. It says nothing at all about peoples. Again, depending upon your rate of retention, it would be anywhere from 2.5 centuries to 5. That is exactly half the time depth that was determined by Wood and Donner. Okay.
Coffee showed up. No. Now we have Dr. C.A. Adrian Heidenreich, the bearing of ethnohistoric data on the chorodactyl separation. Do you have slides?
No, no slides. Impressive information that's been given so far today, I don't probably have a great deal substantive to offer. What I am going to do is to raise some problems, just a few of the issues that I think are important for us to consider in looking at the crow and the hydaxa split. Of course, we know why they really split. The hydaxas claim that the crows pouted and left, and the crows claim that they, as Joe said this morning, had a religious experience and decided to leave. But there's some other problems involved with that from an ethnohistoric perspective. Let me first of all say that in order to understand the crow-hydaxa split, I think we have to begin to become concerned about the underlying cultural structure and the dynamics of culture and ecological adaptation on the northern plains. And I think this is one of the things that we have tended to neglect in looking at this whole pattern. There are a number of reasons for that. One of them is that we have been under the tyranny of the ethnographic analogy, as some scholars would say. That is, we've looked so hard at the historical or ethnohistorical or oral historical data that we have confused our picture based on what we know from previous knowledge, and that blinds us essentially to ferreting out and interpreting our new information. And this has been the case in a number of areas. I want to point out about six to start out with. First of all, one of the problems I think And I'm not saying that I want to take a position either way on some of these problems yet, but these are some of the problems that we have raised for ourselves. First of all, we have made the assumption that there were tribes on the northern plains, and that tribes are separate entities, and that these tribes move around and every once in a while they split, so that we would see that the Crow would split from the Hidatsa, the Assiniboine would split from the Sioux, and so forth. We know that there was really a lot more complexity involved in the northern plains. That is, that each of these groups were in fact developed or organized into sub-tribes, or some people would want to call them bands. Joe indicated that to some extent in his talk this morning, and I think we can get some clues from oral history of that sort. Again, it may not tell us all of the details we want to know, but if we look at some of the clues involved, and Joe was talking about the area around Devil's Lake, in which the Crow people and the Hidatsa people had already split or were in the process of splitting, and yet remained allies, moving to the Missouri River and then taking a part of that group, the Crow part, taking a large migration. That is to say that we're not really talking with complete tribes the way we talk about nations in the Western world. We're talking about groups of people who have a great deal of flexibility within their social organization. And so that the distinction that Wood and Downer make, and that Hugh Matthews has just made about the separation of languages becoming socially separate, can be a little bit different issue than the final physical separation of those people. So what has happened, and the problem with this first point that I want to make, is that we've been under the tyranny of the fact that when the early anthropologists, people like Lowy and Gilbert Wilson and Bowers and other people, came out to study those particular groups, they had been separated for approximately 50 or 100 years in time due to the influences of the white man, that is, the reservation situation, and prior to that, as a matter of fact, going back at least to the early 1780s, if not earlier, the problems of depopulation due to smallpox and the spreading and rejoining of tribes. And I'll come back to that in a little while. But basically what happened is that in the general literature we began having typical tribes. And so we go to colleges and you read a book on the Crow or a book on the Cheyenne, and you forget that these people were, first of all, flexible within their groups, and second, that some of those groups allied with each other at various times and mixed. I'll come back to that here in a little bit. A second problem that we have had that has helped blind us is a heavy reliance, in terms of the Crow-Hidatsa split specifically, a reliance on only one of what are, in effect, many oral traditions. I think Joe has this afternoon indicated to you an alternative, an issue of a dream, and I'll come back to that in a few minutes. But the basic issue is that Wood and Downer have not taken that hypothesis as well as a hypothesis, as well as the quarrel over the buffalo punch. They have limited themselves to one particular oral tradition. And even that oral tradition, the one that they use, the split based on the buffalo punch, has not been read in detail and gone into. I'm going to come back in a little while to that. But in other words, there are a number of oral traditions within a group sometimes. And again, it has been a tendency sometimes, and I think particularly people who are not working directly with a Native American group, or any people, that is, a person who's working at a distance, working through textbooks, through archaeological data, where they don't get to know the people, don't realize the variation within the oral traditions. A third aspect, I think, that's important is that we have been, to some extent, off and on, although I think not in as much as we should, we've been concerned with the specific details of the Crow-Hidatsa split rather than looking at that split in the face of the larger cultural dynamics on the plains. I think this partly goes back to the issue of the band and tribe structure, is to say we have really haven't thought about the real process of the split so much as we have a few of the details. And of course, one of those details is the concern about placing a specific date on it. There's nothing wrong with trying to find a date, just to put a date on a split, either a series of band splits or a tribal split. But the problem is when we focus on a date rather than looking at the process of what's going on, we again blind ourselves. There has been another problem too, a fourth problem, and that is that there has been a kind of an assumption really beginning with Clark Whistler and others. Clark Whistler has really, I think, given us a load that we have taken upon ourselves. I think Whistler himself had much more understanding of the plains area than some of us seem to, but that is the idea of culture areas. And Whistler did, because he was working in a museum context, what he had to do was he had to take all of the collections and materials that had been collected and he had to make a museum display out of it, or a series of displays. And basically he found that one of the easiest ways to do it was to take the typical types of material culture and religious beliefs and food quest and religion, take the typical and put each one in a little separate case. And so he came out with the Eastern Woodlands, the Plains, the Southwest, and so forth. And there's nothing wrong with doing that, because when you step back and look at it, it's accurate. But the problem is that it's not very sophisticated. And so therefore, you ignore the interfaces between the culture areas, number one. And number two, you tend to ignore when people move out of one area into another one. And of course, in this particular case, if the Crow traditions and the Hidatsa traditions are true, that both of those groups came from an Eastern Woodlands base and moved out, they basically moved from an Eastern Woodlands base into a prairie and then into the, at least the Crow, into the high plains. Okay, related to the issue of the discrete culture area problem is that our archaeological surveying, as well as the ethnographic work with particular people, have basically followed the same problems. And so today we've seen that we have a paper done on archaeology of the Crow, or at least of southeastern Montana and northeastern Wyoming. We see some other materials looking at ethnohistoric data gathered primarily around the Hidatsa villages during the historic period of time. It has only been recently, and I think it is significant, that the first paper we heard this afternoon did cover the area in between, that is, this area between the Missouri River and the plains, and indicated something of the use patterns of it, just a very beginning indication. But now this is something we've known for a long time. We've known from the work of Gilbert Wilson and others that the Hidatsas came out and used the western North Dakota and, as a matter of fact, even the eastern Montana region. And I'll come back to that in a few minutes. But as far as our research plan, our research strategy, we totally ignored that region because it's hot, it's dry, it's flat, or else it's badlands, or for whatever reason. And we have basically until the coal companies and pipeline companies, of course, needed it, and then we got all worried. And now, fortunately, we are doing some work in those areas. I'm going to come back to that that issue too momentarily, a little bit later. But in case I don't get back to it, let me draw another point here. There's been a lot made, and it was made by a point made of the movement of tribes up river systems. And Malloy had indicated that the Hidatsas or the Crows may be split off came up the Missouri River, then down the Yellowstone, the Glendive, and built the Hagen site. We will see, we've already seen today the oral tradition that Job talked about, that the tribes came across land. Part of the time they followed rivers, part of the time they cut across land. We'll see here in a few minutes, if I get time to get to it. I've got a very massive paper, so I'm just giving you some high points of it. But we'll see that when Francois Laroque first came to the Hidatsa villages and met the Crow people there, he actually had come for several years, but in 1805, he met some Crows who came to the Hidatsa villages to trade. And when they left the Hidatsa villages to come back into Montana, essentially, if you want to put it that way, they did not follow the river systems. They took off from the Knife River and came across land, hit the Little Missouri, hit across land again, hit the Powder River, and then they followed the Powder River all through Wyoming to Piney Creek, came up Piney Creek, the sites that George Risen was talking about earlier this morning, a very major, major central Crow area during historic times, and I firmly believe too also prehistoric times. And then they followed river systems basically on down to the Yellowstone, somewhere in the vicinity of Huntley or Billings, and then the rock left them and went back to the Yellowstone. They went across country, and again, the issue of, I think partly our notion of culture areas is that in order to get out of a culture area, you have to follow some neat trail, and of course the rivers make the neatest trails, but that's not necessarily the case.